This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents He Who Fights With Monsters 7, a lit RPG adventure. Book 7 of He Who Fights With Monsters, written by Shirtaloon, aka Travis Deverell, performed by Heath Miller. Chapter 1. Of course he doesn't have pants. In outback Australia, there was an empty town left abandoned after the monster waves. No wave had come through, but the town was falling apart anyway, most of the buildings having been empty long before the evacuation. Upriver cotton farming had long ago depleted the town's primary water source, and what was left had been diverted by a major battle between monsters and essence users that had devastated the land to the north. When the waves came to an end, the town hadn't been worth reclaiming. The old football oval had been nothing but patches of dry grass, clinging to a field of dirt when Jason Asano and Farrah Huron claimed it. The handful of buildings and the old grandstand couldn't blame the recent troubles for their state. They had been little more than dried-out shanties long before magic came into the open. Only the bar had seen regular maintenance, even having a coat of paint younger than Jason, if only barely. Something incongruous now occupied the dirt oval. Standing stones, set out in a ritual pattern of concentric circles. At a glance, it looked like someone was attempting to ostentatiously outdo Stonehenge in a ghost town in the middle of nowhere. Jason and Farrah sat in the sun-bleached grandstand, looking out at their work. They'd been sitting there for some time, talking.
"It's time," Jason said.
"You know they're watching us, right?" Farrah asked.
"I do," Jason said, his voice weary. "Every petty faction in this world. Dogs fighting over scraps. Once we're gone, they'll swoop down on this place, looking to plunder any knowledge or power we leave behind."
"Leave them to their petty squabbles," Farrah advised.
Jason nodded. "I'm done," he said, and pushed himself to his feet, the old wood groaning underneath him.
"Did you end up talking to Amy?"
Farrah asked as they left the grandstand and walked towards the standing stones.
"I know you were in two minds about it."
"I did," Jason said. "Not that there was much to say. It was just sad, more than anything. Once upon a time, we knew each other better than we knew ourselves. Now we barely recognize one another."
"She wasn't angry?"
"She was tired. Kaito made his own choice to stand up for his world, and she knows that. It doesn't change the fact that her kids will grow up without their father because he followed me." They reached the standing stones that Farrah had hauled into place using her prodigious strength. They passed between the stones to the empty circle in the middle. It was one of the few patches of lingering grass, jutting from the hard dirt, yellow and brittle.
"You won't be back for a long time," Farrah said. "If you want a last look around Earth, this is it. If we wait another day or two before going, it won't make a difference."
Jason didn't say anything. Instead, he opened a portal to his spirit vault, the extra-dimensional realm that existed within his soul. He stepped through without looking back. Jason's spirit vault was increasingly becoming less of a vault and more of a realm. His power was growing, and the outworlder ability that created it had gone through a rare secondary evolution. It had also been shaped by introducing the dimensional door he had taken from the Builder's control, and the dimensional bridge given freely by the World Phoenix. Most of all, the realm inside his soul was shaped by the tribulations his soul had endured before recovering all the stronger. The layout of his spirit realm reflected his spirit domains, the regions on Earth that existed in normal reality but were under his power. It centered on a towering pagoda tower of smoky crystal, each brick infused with sparkling motes of blue, gold, and silver light that danced within the solid bricks as if they were liquid. From the tower, a vast estate of cloud buildings sprawled out into landscape that ranged from wild groves to carefully cultivated gardens to a cave system filled with luminescent fungus. At the edge of his domain was a wall of darkness that seemed to devour the light around it. Even the starry void beyond was bright by comparison. The most prominent change brought about by the World Phoenix's bridge was that the wall now had an arched gate. Beyond the gate, a rainbow bridge extended into the star-speckled dark. In the distance, a stream of multicolor light passed, coming from the depth's void and disappearing into the distance. Jason had vast power in his spirit realm, and with a blur, he and Farah were standing at the gate. The arch was a solid construction of the same dark, sparkling crystal as the pagoda, while the gate itself seemed wrought from darkness itself, congealed into a metal that seemed to suck in the light. At a gesture from Jason, the gate sank into the ground, opening the dark wall that separated the physical space of his spirit realm from the astral void surrounding it. The rainbow bridge spanned out towards the distant stream of similarly polychromatic light.
"That's the link between your world and mine?" Farah asked.
"Yes," Jason confirmed. "Beyond this wall is the deep astral. What we're seeing is more metaphor than reality. My spirit realm trying to quantify that which cannot be quantified."
"So, how does this work?"
"However I like." Jason flicked his hand, and with that gesture, his entire spirit realm started moving along the rainbow bridge. It accelerated more and more, until Farah realized that what she thought was a narrow stream of energy in the distance was planetary in scale, simply much further away than she realized. As they drew closer, the stream became a vast rainbow wall in front of them, blocking out the starry void behind it. The spirit realm passed into the stream, the rainbow energy engulfing them but not crossing beyond the wall or an invisible dome above it. The gate rose back up, and Jason turned away. The people observing the stone formation from several kilometers away in a helicopter watched as the standing stones transmuted from ordinary desert rock into dark crystal, the inside of it speckled with shifting blue, silver, and gold light. They reported that Jason Asano had left the Earth behind. On Farah's homeworld, the companions Jason had left behind were gathered in a town recently fortified against increasing instances of monster attack. Jason's team, plus Rufus, Gary, and Jory, were all present. There were also two diamond rankers, which was essentially unheard of for some unremarkable town in the middle of nowhere. One was Virid, the weaponsmith whom had become Gary's mentor. He sat behind the group at a feasting table, cowed by the other diamond ranker. Dawn was not using an avatar projection the way she had on Earth. She stood in the fullness of her power, which was so vast that only the other diamond ranker had an inkling of her might. In some parts of the world, such as the one they were in, diamond rankers were barely more than legends themselves. Virid could sense that a similar gulf existed between himself and Dawn. They were both diamond rankers, but she had clearly touched on something that lay beyond both his reach and his understanding. Dawn stood in front of Jason's assembled friends. They couldn't even sense the power she possessed, but were all watching her fiercely. The twisted remains of the sword Gary once gave Jason sat uneasily in Gary's hands. A feast had been going on, but the townsfolk knew adventurer business when they saw it. They had already cleared out the area to give the group a wide berth.
"You're suggesting that Jason is alive?" Sophie asked. "Why should we believe you? If he's alive, where is he?"
"Jason is on his own world," Clive said, surprising the others.
He didn't notice, staring at his feet as he absently scratched his head in thought. He looked up, staring slightly as he noticed everyone looking at him. He turned to Dawn.
"You serve the World Phoenix, don't you?"
he asked her. She smiled.
"He wasn't wrong about you being the smart one," she said. "I spent a lot of time with Jason's collection of astral magic theory. Your notes are impressively insightful, Mr. Standish, especially given the level of astral magic in this world."
"What's a World Phoenix?" Gary asked.
"A great astral being," Clive said. "I only know a little, but my understanding is that it's largely antagonistic to the Builder. Its domain is dimensional integrity, which directly clashes with the Builder's habit of plundering worlds."
"Then where has this great magic whatever been all this time?"
Sophie demanded, thumping a fist down on a wooden feasting table. Her silver rank strength smashed a hole right through it.
Is its other domain taking a nap when it should be getting off its butt and kicking the builder in the fruit basket?
The World Phoenix is famously indirect, Clive said. It works through agents and pawns, which is why information about it is limited. The very fact that one of its agents is here at all is quite worrying. It makes me wonder what the builder had planned that would warrant intervention.
You are right to worry, Dawn said.
What does any of this have to do with Jason? Rufus asked.
Jason always said he had a way back home, Clive said.
One that he didn't know how to use, Sophie added. He showed it to me once. It was an item, red, with a picture of a bird on it.
So it's true then, Clive said. World Phoenix tokens really can bring back the dead.
Yes, Dawn said. This is why they are handed out sparingly. Jason Asano was reborn in his own world.
I thought his world didn't have magic,
Gary said.
What would someone like you be doing there?
Jason's world held many secrets. On returning, he found himself with responsibilities that someone of his rank should not have had to shoulder. Enemies whose power utterly dwarfed his own.
No change there, then, Jory muttered, still picking fights he can't win.
I never said he didn't win, Dawn said. Jason managed to provoke my counterpart within the Builder's forces into overstepping his bounds. This has forced certain compromises on the Builder's part, allowing for my presence here. There are extreme restrictions on my power to intervene directly on events, but I have already started preparing this world for what comes next.
Which is what? Humphrey asked. The team leader stood at the forefront of his assembled companions.
It doesn't matter what else is going on, Sophie said. The issue is Jason.
Since I left Jason's world, Dawn continued, he apparently provoked the Builder's agent again. In recompense, I am allowed a single instance of intervention on behalf of this world, using the full measure of my power. I intend to use it well.
If you were in Jason's world, Sophie said, why didn't you bring him back?
I told you that he has responsibilities, Dawn said. Once they are complete, he will return on his own. Further explanation can be left to Jason himself once he returns. I will warn you that when he arrives, he's bringing the Monster Surge with him.
Monster Surges were a regular event taking place every 10 years or so. The current surge was some 5 years overdue, during which time monster activity had gradually increased. Once the surge proper began, it was expected to be more brutal and last longer than any in history. Why? Rufus asked. How? Is Jason somehow related to why the surge hasn't come?
I will give the details to Mr. Standish soon enough, Dawn said. He's the only one who would truly understand what is happening anyway, and can explain it for you in turn. In the immediacy, I have something that you will want to see more.
Hold on, Humphrey said. You're doing a lot of talking, but words are easy. I haven't seen anything to prove you aren't just playing some game with us.
And he said you were the naive one, Dawn said to Humphrey. Mr. Blacksmith, would you care to reassure them?
The sword, Virid said, standing up. The group suddenly remembered the blade in Gary's hands that Dawn had delivered to the hulking lion man.
If it's truly soul bonded to your friend, and your friend is alive, Virid explained, then it cannot be hidden from Gary in the process of reforging. It will give us a definitive answer.
Still, Belinda said to Dawn, he could have at least given you a recording crystal to bring back to us for evidence.
He did, Dawn said. I've been trying to tell you that, but you keep interrupting. No wonder you all became his friends. You're as bad as he is.
How much time did you spend with Jason? Rufus asked.
You just can't stop, can you? Dawn asked. You genuinely all deserve each other. I spent more time with Jason than you, Mr. Remor. My powers were severely restricted, however. For most of our time together, he was more powerful than I. Now, if you're all quite done,
Does anyone have a recording crystal projector?
Jason and Farah lay back in lounge chairs made out of cloud stuff, watching the rainbow energies pass over Jason's spirit realm. Then they spotted a figure float swiftly past, and they both sat up.
Was that?
Farah asked.
TV's Patrick Duffy.
Yeah, Jason said. I didn't know he was an interdimensional being. Farah gave him a flat look.
Or it's possible that my spirit realm imprinting physical reality onto a non-physical space is causing anomalous manifestations projected through my psyche.
And what your mind threw out was Patrick Duffy.
He was in The Bold and the Beautiful, Dallas and Step by Step, Farah. That's a daytime soap, a primetime soap, and a classic 90s sitcom. All iconic examples of their respective genres. That's not even mentioning The Man from Atlantis.
Most of that is from before you were born. Your father has a lot to answer for.
Those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it, which is probably why they rebooted Dallas. Also, you know a lot for someone who claims to hate television.
I really, really need to get back to my own world.
Clive's crystal projector was set on the picnic table where Virid had been sitting. The group was now all gathered around it.
I haven't seen this, Dawn admitted. We were both rather caught up in events, and he handed it to me as I was leaving his world.
You don't have an image projector? Humphrey asked.
It's primitive magic, Dawn said. My dimensional vessel doesn't have one. I could have gotten one while I was here, but it seemed right that you all should see it first. He made it for you, after all.
She placed the crystal in the projector, and an image blinked to life over the table. It was Jason, covered in blood and dust, wearing nothing but boxer shorts with love hearts on them. He was sporting a slew of wounds, although they were closing swiftly enough that they could see him healing.
Of course he doesn't have pants,
Rufus laughed, the delight at seeing his friend thicken his voice.
I haven't done this in a while, the magic being kind of crap in my world, Jason said. So the recording crystals don't work so well. I'll catch you all up at some point, but I'm kind of in the middle of something right now. I guess I can hit the highlights. Farah's alive? That's a winner. So am I, for that matter. Which maybe...
Gary's hand slammed down, pausing the projection.
Yes, Dawn said. She's alive. I've spent quite some time with her, in fact. You could say she is a mutual friend.
Rufus and Gary shared a look, hope and joy tempered by a fear that all this was some cruel, elaborate ruse. Sophie, who had only heard about Farah, reached out to resume the recording.
More surprising, Jason continued, I die kind of a lot.
Is three times a lot? I mean, three isn't a big number, but not many people hit the triple when it comes to carking it. I think three counts as a lot. He panned the crystal away from himself, showed off some kind of city street with an architectural style that none of them were familiar with. There was debris all over the street, courtesy of a collapsed nearby building. Jason panned the crystal back to himself.
I'm saving the world, so I'd best get back to it, he said. As you can see, I'm standing in my underwear in the middle of the street, covered in blood, next to a building I just blew up. The street is in an extra-dimensional city I'm taking over so a hole doesn't get blasted in the side of the universe. Mondays, am I right?
Oh, wait, you have a six-day week.
Still, it's a day of the week. It's not that hard to pick up from context.
A hole in the universe? Clive asked. How is that even possible? And why is...
Clive! Jason's projection cut in, wagging a disapproving finger. I know you've got questions, but stop interrupting. People are trying to listen to the recording. Be courteous and wait.
The group burst out laughing at the expression on Clive's face, the tension breaking like an overflowing dam. They watched Jason pull out a flask of cleaning solution and pour it over himself. He winced as it stung his wounds.
Jory, if you're watching this, I want you to know I have a new appreciation for the quality of your crystal wash. I'm going to need quite a lot of it once I get back, by the way. Like, a lot. I don't want to go running out again, so way more than last time.
Jason tipped another flask of the cleaning solution over some strange-looking weapons before putting them away in his inventory. Anyway, none of my essence abilities work here, which sucks. I spent the last few hours fighting it out with a small army of astronauts with ray guns, which was pretty awesome. I'll explain what they are later. Jason reached up to the crystal, and the projection ended. Chapter 2. Connotations. A bird fluttered out of Humphrey's jacket, then transformed into a puppy as it landed on the table and pawed at the projector. Humphrey scooped him up and petted him gently.
"It's all right, little buddy,"
he cooed soothingly.
"That's it?"
Neil complained as the recording ended.
"That didn't tell us anything. I'm so glad he's alive and I can go back to hating him."
"Neil,"
Humphrey scolded.
"What?"
Neil asked. Clive shook his head while Belinda snorted a laugh. Jory was contemplating the return of the crystal wash vampire while Sophie was looking shell-shocked. Humphrey reached out to her, but she flinched away. He looked hurt and she winced apologetically. Sophie couldn't get out any more words and left in a half run. Humphrey moved to follow, but Belinda placed a restraining hand on his arm.
"You'd do more harm than good at this point," she told him. "She needs a friend, not whatever you are. I have to do something."
"You've had plenty of time to do something," Belinda said, the barbs in her voice dripping venom. "If you'd mustered up some courage any time in the last 2 years, then she wouldn't have been stuck between a ghost and a coward. Now the ghost is coming back, so it's time to give it up or rummage around those fancy pants and see if you can't dig out some balls."
She snatched puppy stash from Humphrey's arms and marched off in Sophie's direction, leaving a crestfallen Humphrey behind her. Rufus and Gary looked at one another as if asking for permission to hope. Seeing Jason alive was one thing, but hearing about Farrah without seeing her gave them a fearful unreality. They shared the fear of their hope being cruelly snatched away.
"Mr. Standish," Dawn said, "perhaps you can join me for a lengthy discussion."
Farrah groaned as she watched Jason go through a meditative sword dance, again. They were on a terrace in Jason's spirit realm, the rainbow lights of the world link washing over them.
"How long until we get back?"
"I told you that I don't know," Jason said, his smooth, graceful movements continuing uninterrupted. "And if that changes, I'll let you know."
"Are you going to meditate all day, every day? I know training is important, but you're getting worse than Rufus."
"I've been on Earth too long," Jason said. "Standards are going to be higher than I'm used to, and I have no intention of falling behind. It wouldn't hurt you to do a little practice yourself."
"Fine," Farrah conceded. "At least change it up a bit, though. How about a spa?"
"As in a practice fight or a fizzy bath?"
"There's a spa bath here?"
Farrah asked, perking up.
"There can be," Jason said.
"How about we do both?" Farrah was disoriented as she suddenly found herself standing in front of Jason in a wide-open dueling area. She looked down to find her Earth clothes had been replaced with a training gi.
"Did you use your half-cooked god powers to change my clothes?"
"Nope,"
Jason lied. "You were wearing that the whole time." Farrah conjured her sword.
"I'm going to enjoy this."
Belinda walked through the dark outside the town, her way lit by a floating silver lantern shedding a clean, white-blue light. It gave her a refreshing feeling as its aura replenished her mana. This was Shimmer, her astral lantern familiar. She found Sophie sitting on a rock on a small rise, staring up at the night sky. She sat next to her friend, leaning into her by way of greeting.
"I'm not looking to talk," Sophie said.
Belinda passed stash into Sophie's lap and plucked a bottle of amber liquid from her storage space. She took a swig and handed over the bottle.
"Who said anything about talk?" she asked.
They sat in silence, passing the bottle back and forth as Sophie scratched the napping stash behind the ears.
"I don't... God damn it,"
Sophie said.
I haven't seen you in how long, and that fool still hasn't made a move, Belinda complained. Humphrey's an idiot.
He's not an idiot.
You're both idiots, Belinda said. Why haven't you made a move? Since when do you dance about instead of taking what you want?
You know since when, Sophie said. It's like Jason has been sitting between us this whole time, and now...
Sophie took a big gulp, letting the silver rank liquor burn her throat.
And now he's coming back,
Belinda finished, as Sophie handed her the bottle.
What do I do, Lindy?
Sophie asked, her voice uncharacteristically small.
The thing about death, Belinda said, is that we don't look back at things the way they were. We tell ourselves stories and pretend that they're memories. After a while, we forget that they aren't.
What are you saying?
That he's coming back and it's not about the stories anymore. I knew Jason better than you, Soph, because I wasn't tied up in 9 kinds of mess the way you were. You hated him, and then you...
Belinda sighed before continuing.
Even when he was alive, Soph, Asano was always one story or another to you. You thought too little or too much of him and never looked at him for what he really was.
Which was what?
Some guy. He was kind of amazing and kind of a turd, but he was still just some guy. But now he's a myth in your head, and you can't expect him to live up to that.
I don't seem to be coming off well in this description, Sophie said, taking the bottle back.
You weren't in a well place, Sophie. And Jason never really knew you either. You spent your whole life building a fortress, and he was long gone before you learned to open the gates. He was going through his own stuff, too. If you think either of you are the same people you were then, you're deluding yourself.
Belinda pushed herself off the rock, wobbly with drink.
In the end, Humphrey and Jason don't matter, she said. This is about you. Be who you are. Make sure you're chasing what you want and not what you think you should want. That will only hurt everyone, yourself most of all.
Belinda staggered off into the darkness, in the vague direction of the town, her familiar bobbing after her.
What if I'm already hurt?
Sophie whispered into the dark.
Which is why Jason's return to our world will trigger the monster surge,
Clive concluded. Some of the villagers had stopped to listen, returning to gather around the feasting tables lined along the main thoroughfare and still loaded with food. Their initial fascination quickly waned as Clive started explaining astral magic to the group in more detail than any of his audience wanted.
Did the explanation have to be that long? Neil asked. What you just said is that the monster surge isn't happening because of a bad magic thing that some stupidly powerful whatever made. Jason, being Jason, heard stupidly powerful, immediately decided to annoy it and blew up its magic thing? Now the monster surge is back on, with a bonus invasion, and Jason's coming here to probably get us all killed.
I wouldn't characterize that as entirely accurate, Clive said.
Why is Jason building this bridge to this town in the middle of nowhere anyway? Neil asked. I'm not even sure where we are.
He's not coming to this place, Dawn said. What he's doing is outside of even my experience. He may arrive at the same location he arrived the first time, somewhere completely random, or at a location equivalent to one of his...
What is it?
Clive asked, after Dawn trailed off.
Some things are better not said aloud, she said. Suffice to say, any potential location for Jason's arrival would be a guess on our part.
Then what are we doing all the way out here? Neil asked. Does this town even have a name?
Of course it has a name, Jory said.
What is it?
I don't exactly remember, Jory admitted.
Mr. Zandia was here, Dawn said. I needed his help, and this place has fewer eyes and ears. I had enough influence with the Adventure Society to send you all here, so I did.
You've been warning the Adventure Society? Humphrey said.
Yes, Dawn acknowledged. This will not merely be cultists snatching away astral spaces. This will be war.
Dawn departed from the group to resume her work preparing Adventure Society branches across the world as best she could. She travelled in a strange vessel that was a cottage inside a giant floating orb. Rufus returned to Greenstone, both to settle his affairs before Jason's arrival, and in case it was the place he arrived. With no better plan than to wait, the others left for the city of Zartos, home to Gary's mentor, Virid. It held the Diamond Ranker's personal smithy.
"It's the best place to forge a great work," Virid had assured them.
Gary and Virid spent days examining the sword, seeking to understand it before beginning the process of reforging it. They carefully selected the supplemental materials they would use and familiarized themselves with the soul echo bonded to the weapon. The forging was a collaboration, not just between Gary and Virid, but also Jason. In many ways, it was the soul bond that guided the most critical aspects of the work and shaped the final result. Zartos was a subterranean city built around an underground river, largely populated by Celestines. While Gary and Virid worked, the others enjoyed their reunion. None of them had felt entirely whole as a team since Jason's death. As with Rufus and Gary, the loss of a friend and companion had led to them taking separate paths where previously they would have resisted. Gary and Virid were sealed away in Virid's smithy for 19 days before they finally emerged. The sword Gary showed the team was wholly unlike what it had been before. More than just a change in appearance, the blade had a domineering aura. It gave a sense that even looking at it was somehow a transgression. There was a benevolence as well, but an imperious one, looking down from above.
"That's quite a weapon, Gary," Humphrey said. "A real aura from a weapon is quite a feat, especially an aura that strong."
"Virid covered many of the flaws in my technique," Gary confessed. "He pushed me to heights I could not reach alone. The aura comes from the soul bond, which guided us in the reforging. It's like the sword knew what it wanted to be."
The hilt was a simple design of milk-white metal with onyx embellishments and bone grip. The blade was a black so dark as to be unnerving, as if looking upon it was forbidden. Symbols were carved into the blade, starkly contrasted in white.
"That's the same language used in the brand Jason inflicts with his spell," Clive said. "The one that applies the mark of sin affliction."
"That brand was on me once," Sophie said. "It actually means something?"
"It's an ideographic language," Clive said.
"A what?"
Sophie asked. Like Jason, Clive had the power to speak and read all languages. Unlike Jason, he had used it as a springboard for study.
"It's a language where a single symbol can embody a complex concept," Clive explained. "Whether a symbol is alone or contextualized by others can hugely impact the meaning. The symbol from Jason's brand translates to sinner, which makes sense. It's accompanied by an affliction called the mark of sin."
"Are these symbols Jason's native language?"
Belinda asked.
"No," Clive said. "This is something much older."
"I don't even know what it says," Gary admitted. "It just kind of felt right to mark the blade this way as I was working at it. It's the soul bond. I named the original sword Dread Salvation, but I think it might have renamed itself, and that's what we're looking at. What does it say, Clive?"
"Hegemon's Will."
"You said one symbol conveys a complex concept, right?" Sophie asked.
"It can," Clive said. "This language has the primary conceptual symbols and the secondary contextual symbols."
"The sword has six symbols," Sophie said. "That seems like a lot of context for a short name."
"There are connotations," Clive said.
"What kind of connotations?" Sophie asked.
"You felt the aura," Clive said. "Those kind of connotations."
"Oh, great," Neil said. "Sounds like Jason's time away gave him the humility he so badly needed."
The journey was proving immensely valuable to Jason. The tiny bubble of his spirit realm was a projection of his soul being cast through the infinity of the deep astral. Only the world link it clung to saved him from drifting helplessly forever. His soul was immersed in magic at its most pure and powerful. Even simple meditation accelerated his insights into the most fundamental aspects of cosmic power. His most common meditative technique was the Dance of the Sword Fairy that Rufus had taught him. Jason was trying to get a better grasp of entering the combat trance state, which he was still struggling to master fully. More than just a simple battle trance, he sought oneness with the cosmos that he was closer to now than he was likely to ever be again.
You're not Luke Skywalker,
Farah called out from her lounger. Shut up, he said, continuing his sword dance uninterrupted.
Anakin, maybe? Prequels, not Clone Wars.
Jason stumbled.
That's just low, he muttered, as she laughed.
Farah was less enamored than Jason of the journey. For her, it was more waiting, which she'd done plenty of while Jason was in the two transformation zones. She became increasingly agitated as her home, family, and friends grew closer, yet felt so far away. Days turned into weeks as they continued their passage through the astral. Jason went back to his meditative dance as she was listening to music on a recording crystal, lounging in a deck chair made of clouds.
This is not traditional meditative music, Jason commented.
If you don't like Laura Branigan, that's not my problem.
Jason stopped his sword dance again.
I'm the one who... You didn't give her essences as well, did you?
I wouldn't do that without telling you.
No?
Do we need to discuss Pat Benatar? Who told... I have no idea what you're talking about.
I should have worked harder to get you back home, Jason said, shaking his head. He tilted back to look helplessly at the rainbow sky. I think you've gone native.
His eyes narrowed, still looking up.
Was that a tree?
Chapter 3. What a Monster Surge Feels Like. Gary, Jory, and Jason's team, minus Jason himself, were on the open deck of a skyship headed for Vitesse, the City of Flowers.
Is everyone feeling that? Humphrey asked as something pricked at his magical senses.
The others nodded their agreement as they felt a tremulation in the ambient magic, as if the world itself was shivering. It started small but grew rapidly in strength, soon shaking the airship with turbulence.
What is this? Sophie asked. Is this what a monster surge feels like?
No, Clive said. This is something else.
The rainbow light over Jason's spirit realm slowly faded to be replaced with a blank grey. As it did, escalating levels of plant debris were blasting past, as if a hurricane was blowing over his protected realm. Foliage, branches, and even whole trees were flung past like a swarm of insects caught in a gale. Their number only increased as the grey light faded to darkness. By the time the light was entirely gone, there was a constant stream of debris passing overhead, only visible in the light coming from Jason's shielded spirit realm. The violent display was eerily silent as the debris was ripped through the air by devastating winds.
What's going on? Farah asked.
We've arrived, Jason said. In the middle of a storm, in the middle of the night. A cyclone, from the looks of it. There goes my plan to step out and take in a lungful of clean, fresh air.
We don't breathe.
Oh, yeah.
Belinda and Clive had already rushed below decks to see if they could help the engineers right the skyship as it moved from poorly controlled flight towards poorly controlled fall. Neil and Gary were ushering other passengers below decks while Sophie and Humphrey had jumped overboard, using flight, teleport, and other movement powers to retrieve the few already bucked off by violent turbulence. There were other adventurers amongst the passengers who likewise stepped in to stem the chaos. Eventually, the ship righted itself and Clive and Belinda came back up, accompanied by the chief engineer.
I didn't even know you could do that with resonating cascade rods,
the frazzled engineer praised Belinda.
Improvisation is a specialty of hers, Clive said. If you ever need to take her prisoner, I'd just have a guard hit her on the head every time she regains consciousness, and sometimes when she hasn't, to make sure.
Hey, Belinda complained.
I once saw her take down a trap barrier from the inside with a broken wand and a device for checking the freshness of fish,
Clive continued. The team regrouped on the top deck, along with key members of the crew and some other adventurers who had helped out.
Any idea what's happening? The captain asked the chief engineer.
It's not a problem with the ship, the chief engineer said. Ship sensors are reading massive disruptions in the ambient magic as far as they'll reach. We've managed to cobble together an adaption to compensate, but it won't hold. We need to get on the ground slow before we hit it fast.
It's the monster surge, Clive said. It's starting.
I've lived through three monster surges,
the captain said. Monster searchers don't do this.
This one does, Clive said.
We picked up something on the ship's sensors, the chief engineer said. Something big and strange somewhere off to starboard.
They all looked, but saw only clear skies.
I think your sensors are wrong, one of the adventurers said.
No, Clive said. You don't see it because it doesn't exist yet.
What is that supposed to mean?
The adventurer asked.
You're talking out of your...
He trailed off as a rainbow light erupted in the sky, above and starboard of the ship. It was the rainbow light of a magic manifestation, but the size was almost incomprehensibly vast.
I don't suppose there's any chance that's a really, really big awakening stone, Neil said.
It has to be a diamond rank monster, right?
One of the adventurers said.
That's too big even for gold rank.
I saw a diamond rank manifestation 2 monster surges back, the captain said. Even that wasn't this big.
Captain, the chief engineer said, I take back what I said about getting onto the ground slowly. Let's get out of here as fast as we can.
The captain and engineer ran off towards their stations.
This is what Dawn warned us about, isn't it?
Belinda asked.
I think so, Clive said. I don't think being nearby is a good idea. We should go help the engineer keep this thing afloat while we get out of here.
Normal manifestations take a while, right?
Jory asked, especially the big ones.
Yes, Clive said. Hopefully we're well away before something comes out of that light.
Jason opened a portal from his spirit realm, and he and Farah finally set foot on Farah's home world. It was not a friendly welcome. They were immediately blasted with horizontal rain and the powerful wind that was tearing up the plants and trees of the tropical jungle in which they found themselves. They could barely stay on their feet despite their silver rank strength because they didn't weigh enough. Farah had to conjure her heavy stone armor while shadow arms reached out to anchor Jason to nearby trees and rocks. Barely able to see through the wind and rain, they moved downward of a rocky rise, hunkering down as the storm raged past them. Their clothes were already drenched, clinging to their bodies as they crouched down out of the worst of the wind.
"Wish I still had my magic umbrella," Jason said through voice chat. Trying to speak over the howling wind would be pointless. "I left it with Emmy."
"It was Iron Rank anyway," Farah said. "It would have had a hard time with storm magic this strong. We're in a high magic zone and this storm has soaked up some of the ambient magic."
"What kind of luck do we have to arrive in a place like this?"
Jason wondered.
"It depends," Farah said. "We might be in the Sea of Storms, which is an accurate, if unimaginative, name."
Jason pulled up his map power and zoomed out to a global scale. Their location was marked as somewhere in the Caribbean Sea. As he had never been to this world's equivalent, he saw no details, only the outlines of landmasses. There seemed to be 3 additional major islands compared to Jason's world south of the Greater Antilles. Jason and Farah were on an island sufficiently minor that at the current scale it didn't even appear on the map. Jason shared the ability to see the map with Farah. As Farah had guessed, their zone was listed at the top as Sea of Storms, Storm Kingdom.
"You weren't wrong about the unimaginative names," Jason said.
"We're in the Storm Kingdom," Farah confirmed. "It rules the Sea of Storms, all the islands on it, and all the coastal regions that surround it."
"Your world doesn't have Christopher Columbus or cruise lines, so it's probably nicer here than the equivalent region of Earth," Jason said.
"Don't be so sure. We have magic, and it's called the Sea of Storms for a reason. Storm season is 2/3 of the year, and this is a high magic zone. They have special measures to prevent the storm stripping towns and cities down to the foundations."
"But it's nice otherwise,"
Jason asked cheerfully, drawing a laugh from Farah.
"So I've heard. But I've never been here before. Emir has, but he's not allowed back. He stole something from the royal family a few years back."
"That rings a bell," Jason said.
"I think he told me about that once.
Speaking of Emir, how about we find the coast, pull out a cloud ship, and change into some dry clothes?"
"I like this plan. Just use that map power to make sure we aren't going in circles. I've no interest in doing laps of a jungle in the midst of ripping itself out of the ground."
"Shade! What do you have for us?"
Jason shouted into the wind. Darkness spilled out of Jason's shadow, taking the form of a beetle the size of a short passenger bus. On the beetle's back was a dome of translucent chitin, the inside of which was hollow. The beetle had a pair of large, multi-jointed arms that were longer than its other legs. The translucent chitin opened a gap as the hard substance turned to liquid and flowed to make a round hole. The long arms picked up Jason and Farah and deposited them inside. Climbing or jumping in the blasting wind would be a difficult proposition. The gap closed behind them, shutting out the wind, rain, and noise. Chairs made of soft, comfortable shadow stuff rose from the dark chitin under their feet.
"Nice one, Shade," Jason said.
"It seemed appropriate for the terrain," Shade said.
"This is a treasure beetle, right?" Farah asked, as she started stripping off her wet clothes and pulling dry ones from her dimensional bag. "I've heard of them, but never seen one, because they get hunted down as soon as they're found."
"I'm assuming that's something to do with the reason they're called treasure beetles?" Jason said, turning to look away despite Farah's unconcern. He changed his clothes using his inventory system, dark mist emerging and swapping his outfits before dispersing again.
"They're very sensitive to materials with large amounts of magic," Farah explained as she pulled fresh clothes from a dimensional bag. "Ores, magic herbs, items left behind when some adventurer died alone. They can burrow very well and harvest herbs without damaging them using those big arms. They store them in their hollow see-through shells, which preserves the magic."
"They're a walking treasure trove. Not a fantastic survival trait."
The skyship shuddered as it pushed its speed while also running on jury-rigged modifications to handle the disrupted ambient magic conditions. Anyone not an adventurer or crew member had been banished below decks, although there had been few complaints. Belinda and Clive were working with the engineer in the bowels of the ship while the rest of their group watched the manifestation they hoped to escape before whatever was coming out of the rainbow light appeared. They realized that they had underestimated the size of it as they moved away rapidly while it continued to loom large in the sky above them.
"On the bright side," Gary said, "this means Jason and Farah are either here or will be soon, right?"
"That's what Clive said," Jory confirmed. "Then it's just a matter of finding them."
"It's going to be a mess getting information with a monster surge going on," Humphrey said, "especially this one. The Adventure Society is going to be tying up all the public water link chambers, making long-range communications tricky. My family always has a private link chamber in our family compounds, although they will no doubt be busy as well."
"Church of Knowledge?" Neil suggested.
"Jason had a way to come back before he left," Sophie said. "If she didn't tell us that after he died, why would she help us now?"
"It's worth trying anyway," Humphrey said. "Our best bet is the Adventure Society, though. If Jason checks in with any branch, his status will be updated across every branch. Then we'll know where to go."
"Look," Neil said, pointing.
"I think it's happening."
The rainbow light started to fade, and something was appearing in its place, shimmering into being like a ghost.
"Dawn was telling the truth," Sophie said weakly. "It really is a city."
An entire city was coming into being in the air, floating high above the ground. The underside was all rock, as if the city had been ripped from the ground, while the rest was a stone city surrounded by high walls with towers jutting out over the top.
"Well, damn," Neil said.
The island Jason and Farah were on proved to be both small and uninhabited. Shade's treasure beetle form navigated the jungle terrain handily, and they soon reached the coast where Jason opened his cloud flask. The clouds streaming out were teased by the wind, but no more, the cyclonic power of the storm insufficient to disrupt the cloud's flask magic. Soon a massive pleasure craft was resting calmly on a sea that was anything but. The boat was the size of a superyacht, but it wasn't in the Earth design style, being more like the ones Jason had seen at the Greenstone Marina. He had spent a pleasant day with Cassandra Mercer on such a boat, not that long before she dumped him. Jason and Farah went aboard, and several Shade bodies took the role of crew.
"My map is a blank, other than raw geography," Jason said.
"Should we just steer towards a big island and see what we get?"
Jason brought up a map of the Sea of Storms on the wall. Because the cloud flask was soul-bonded, it was able to replicate his map ability, at least to display a map. The more tactical functions, like enemy tracking, were still restricted to Jason himself.
"These islands here," Farah said, pointing off the coast of what on Earth was Venezuela.
"I think one of those is Aruba," Jason said. "Works for me. I'm pretty sure the boat can handle the weather, so you can set out, Shade. What is this place we're going to?"
"The capital of the Storm Kingdom, Rimuros," Farah said.
"Rimuros," Jason said. "I met a woman named Rimuros. I heard she was the princess or something, which I guess is here. Hey, I know a local."
"How do you know a princess of the Storm Kingdom?"
"You know how it is," Jason said, putting his hands on his hips and looking off into the middle distance.
"What are you doing?"
"A beautiful young princess. Cloistered away her whole life on her first real expedition into the world. She meets a dashing young hero with a wide selection of confectionery slices."
"That is not how they raise princesses in the Storm Kingdom.
A delicate flower, waiting to be plucked by gentle yet masculine hands."
"Okay, that needs to stop right now, and you might want to avoid leaning on that connection. We should keep our heads down and not make trouble, which I'll remind you is kind of not your thing."
"Oh, I learned that lesson," Jason said. "I got to be a famous superhero, and it turned out to suck. I say we find the nearest Adventure Society branch, quietly do our part with the Monster Surge, find our teams, and finish up this magic bridge without making any waves."
"You know it's never going to be that simple," Farah told him. "You don't seriously think you can avoid being caught up in the Builder invasion, right?"
"A bloke can dream, can't he?"
"Even if you can," she said, "you're still you."
"What does that mean?"
"What's that?" Humphrey asked. "Are those airships coming out of the city?" One of the adventurers around them cast a spell, and the air in front of them shimmered. When it settled, everything seen through it looked much closer, and they could clearly make out the skyships. They rose over the walls of the city and even emerged from tunnels in the rock underneath.
"Am I mistaken in thinking that it looks like two of those things are coming right for us?" Neil said.
"No, you're not," Humphrey said. "Sophie, go get Lindy and Clive."
Chapter 4. Strategic Doctrine.
"Clive," Humphrey said. "Is that a kind of skyship you're familiar with?"
"No,"
Clive said.
The group watched the two approaching skyships using the vision magnifying spell one of the other adventurers around them had shared. The two approaching skyships were unlike any the group had seen. If Jason had been present, he would have noticed a resemblance to old ironclad ships from the American Civil War. They had a decidedly industrial look, with plenty of thick, crude metal plating and smoke pouring from a pair of stacks on the top. On the deck of the approaching skyships were construct creatures, humanoid in shape but resembling their vessel in that they were made from crude industrial metal.
"The craftsmanship isn't there to be true golems," Clive assessed. "Are those constructs what the Builder cult was using when they attacked the expedition from Greenstone?"
"Similar," Neil said, "although those were monster-shaped rather than people-shaped. What's the difference between a construct and a golem?"
"Golems are a specific type of construct," Gary explained, "usually shaped like oversized people. They're more powerful than most other constructs. They're less common because they're expensive and hard to make."
Gary was more familiar with Builder construct creatures than most, having studied them extensively in the wake of the expedition that claimed Farah's life.
"Clive," Humphrey said, "if our skyship gets attacked, can it stay in the air?"
"I'm not sure it can stay in the air even if it doesn't," Clive said.
"Can we outrun them?"
Jory asked.
"For what looks like flying lumps of iron, those airships seem fairly fast."
"The crew is already pushing it harder than they should to maintain this speed," Belinda said. "If we don't crash first, they're going to catch us."
"All right," Humphrey said. "That narrows our options." He turned to the other group of adventurers on the deck with them. "We'll take the first airship. Are you good to take the second?" One of the adventurers stepped forward.
"I don't see as we have a choice," she said. "We'll get it done."
Humphrey nodded and then turned to his own group. "Gary, Jory, are you in?"
"I may have given up adventuring," Gary said, "but I'm not going to just stand around when trouble comes looking."
I need to stop spending time with you people, Jory complained. I only ever get in fights when you're around.
Good man,
Gary said, slapping him on the back almost hard enough to send him over the side.
Clive and I can port 4 people each, Humphrey said. I'll go first with Sophie, Gary and Lindy to claim some ground, and Clive will follow up with the rest. Everyone ready up?
Everyone grabbed gear from dimensional bags and storage spaces or conjured it outright. Sophie pulled on a pair of tight, thin gloves, while Jory put away his coat and pulled out another one, covered in pockets. Clive took out a wand and a staff and started drawing ritual circles in the air with his finger to attach to the ends of them. Gary wore armor that looked like an overheating furnace and took a shield and hammer from his dimensional bag. Belinda was engulfed in silver mist, which quickly faded to reveal a female Leonid with forged armor, shield, and hammer, courtesy of Gary. Gary's eyes went wide.
Oh, hey, Lindy, he said. How's it going?
I'm not really a Leonid, Gary.
We're essence users,
Gary said.
It's not who you are on the inside that matters. It's what you look like that counts.
You're going to let that go? Neil asked Jory.
Yep, Jory said.
You don't feel any need to defend your lady?
She can take care of herself, Jory said. If she wants my help, she'll ask. She's not shy.
Leonid Belinda leaned down to give Jory a peck on the cheek.
That tickles, he said, as her fur brushed his face.
If we're quite done, Humphrey asked. He had conjured up his dragon armor, the scales shimmering with rainbow colors, and a sword stylized as a dragon's wing. Sophie, Humphrey, Gary, and Belinda vanished as Humphrey teleported them to the closest enemy skyship. From inside the massive yacht, Jason and Farah lounged in luxury as they watched the storm rage outside. The wild seas and sweeping winds did not trouble the cloud ship. The interior rested as gently as a baby in a cradle, even as the exterior smashed through waves like a battering ram.
I need to run you through some important aspects of local culture before we arrive, Farah said. With the monster surge, there will be a lot of adventurers that aren't local, so people will be a little more accommodating in regard to etiquette, but that will only go so far.
That's a good idea, Jason said. Easier to lay low if I know the rules. I didn't think you'd been to Rimaros, though.
I haven't, but it's one of the big adventuring cities like Vitesse. If we'd had time to train you properly, you'd have learned all this. But you had more than enough to catch up on as it was.
Okay, sexy teacher Farah time it is.
Are you looking to get spanked?
Is that a trick question? I have been a naughty boy.
That's enough out of you, Farah said.
Yes, mistress.
Farah shook her head.
At least that brings us to the first and most important thing you need to know, which is that everything about you is bad and you shouldn't do it.
That's a little harsh.
Jason, Rimaros isn't some little provincial town where people will leave you be because you have a few high-rank friends. There is an expectation of respect to those both higher and lower rank than you. If a gold ranker messes with you, the Adventure Society will come down on them like a hammer, so long as you weren't acting like you. If you talk to gold rankers like you talk to everyone with more power than you, they'll slap you through a wall and no one will say a thing because you were asking for it.
Sounds fair.
I wish Gary was here. We could bet on how many hours it takes for a gold ranker to punt you into the ocean.
I can be respectful.
A conclusion based on what evidence?
That's a little hurtful.
Look, just don't get up in anyone's face, Farah said. There's a lot of reasons not to go roaming around during a monster surge, especially this one. First and foremost is that whatever else we have going on, we're adventurers. This is a time where we step up and earn all the privileges we enjoy.
Jason nodded his agreement. He wasn't going to skip out on the monster surge, which was exactly the level of responsibility he wanted. After having the fate of the world on his shoulders, the idea of being an inconsequential, rank-appropriate part of a larger effort was exactly the palate cleanser he was looking for.
There are other reasons for participating in the monster surge, of course. The chance to kill some of those builder pricks is at the top of my personal list. Plus, if the Adventure Society finds out you did anything other than report to your nearest branch and do what you're told, you'll find things get tricky after the monster surge. Getting decent contracts suddenly gets hard, and assessing society resources gets harder.
So we'll report in, do our part, and then move on, Jason said. Two unremarkable silver rankers who came back from the dead. Maybe it won't be a big deal because knowledge told people I was alive? He thought about it for a moment. No, she didn't see me die, he said. Knowing her, she'd probably say something about being the goddess of knowledge and not the goddess of solid deductions made on the basis of reasonable evidence.
Knowing her?
We're acquainted, Jason said. I wouldn't say friends, though. There's some tension there. Farah put her face in her hands.
We haven't even met a single person, and you're talking about socializing with a deity, she complained.
It's fine, he assured her. I mean, have I met a bunch of gods? Yes, but it's not like we hang out. Farah gave him a flat look. I told you it's fine. What's the next thing I need to know about our destination?
What's the signature drink? Does it have coconuts? I love coconuts. I don't know the signature drink.
What kind of half-baked training did you go through? I should make some notes for Rufus and his family's academy. They could do responsible service of alcohol certifications. What's better than an adventurer? An adventurer with an RSA.
Gary's huge hammer had its name, Gary's medium hammer, engraved on the metal shaft of the handle. Held in one hand, he smashed it down onto another of the crude metal constructs they were fighting on the open deck of the enemy's skyship. Most of them were only bronze rank, which was good, because they were tougher than equivalent rank monsters, and there were a lot of them. The silver rank ones, scattered amongst them, were extremely tough, along with being overpoweringly strong. If not for their relatively slow and clumsy movement, the numbers swarming the open deck of the skyship would have overwhelmed the team. Fortunately, Gary's hammer was the right tool for the job. Ever since Farah's death, he had made his personal weapons specialized to fight constructs and the freakish cultists that incorporated construct parts into their bodies. Even so, the silver rank constructs boasted an almost implausible resilience. Belinda was wielding a replica of Gary's hammer he had made for her, but the rest of the team would exhaust themselves before dealing with all the constructs. The team had a lot of abilities that allowed them to endure, from cooldown reduction to mana recovery in auras and active abilities. Even so, more and more of the constructs emerged from the lower decks, as if there was a barracks down there where the constructs were slowly waking up. For this reason, the group switched to a strategy based on using the strengths of the constructs against them. The power and resilience of the constructs also made them heavy. Combined with their chosen mode of transport, a skyship, the solution was made obvious by Jory. He had drunk a large potion that transformed him into a hulking brute, even stronger than the constructs, and started flinging them over the side. Even if they survived the 2 kilometer drop, they were no longer an immediate threat.
"We aren't over a town or something, are we?" Humphrey yelled out to Clive. Clive was off the side of the skyship, floating on top of his tortoise familiar, Onslow. Clive looked down and saw only uninhabited rocky badlands. Clive gave Humphrey the thumbs up.
"We're switching to a four-guy strategy," Humphrey bellowed, and the team moved into action.
Humphrey had been the driving force in building a comprehensive tactical and strategic doctrine. Jason had been the driving force behind their names. Jory wasn't familiar with the team's strategies, but was already ahead of the curve in throwing enemies overboard. Gary's powerful roar could blast the weaker bronze rank ones off the ship in small clusters, and Belinda, currently in Leonid form, could do the same. Gary and Belinda held the line while the rest of the team went to work. Sophie seemed to be everywhere at once. One moment she was stalling a construct long enough for a team member to deal with it. The next, she was positioning herself so that Neil could drop an explosive shield on her and blast one or even two constructs over the side. Then she leapt overboard herself, where Clive used his switch teleport spell. Sophie was suddenly amongst the constructs again, having swapped places with a construct, now plummeting towards the ground. Most of the team's familiars were also in play. Belinda's lantern was mostly serving to replenish mana, as its attacks did little to the constructs. Her other familiar was replicating Humphrey, swinging a huge sword at the enemy. Onslow was hitting constructs with various elemental powers. At silver rank, his abilities were more sophisticated, with control aspects to go with the existing raw power. Electricity attacks were especially effective on the metal constructs, although focused wind and water attacks also knocked them around and sometimes off the boat entirely. Stash was more elusive, mostly going unseen.
Then a giant bird would scoop up a construct and drop it off the ship, or a tentacle would snake over the side and drag one overboard. Occasionally, a different and more dangerous enemy would arise from below decks of the enemy ships. One was an ogre-like construct, obviously more powerful than the others, along with being much better made. This was a true golem, not as clumsy or slow as the others. Belinda used her Pit of the Reaper ability to conjure an inverted, extra-dimensional pit of shadows over the ship. Shadow arms reached down from its maw, plucking up constructs and dragging them in. Many arms picked up the golem, but couldn't haul it into the pit. It fought itself free of the arms with prodigious strength, but it was too late. The skyship was still on the move, and in the time the golem freed itself, the pit had been left behind. The golem fell through the air in the skyship's wake. The golem was not the last dangerous construct to emerge from the bowels of the ship. The next was much smaller, but also much prettier. A complete divergence from the heavy constructs and even the golem, this was a finely crafted and delicate sculpture. With many long, thin, interwoven parts, it looked somewhere between a winged insect and a chandelier. Sunlight glinted from its polished silver body, with many legs and four mantis-like blade arms. It was as much artwork as death machines.